everyone, and welcome to episode number 14 of the Forensic Anthropology Companion Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kenny Hurst. Today, I'll be joined by...
Hi, my name is Omar Afra, and I am a PhD student interested in ameliorating missing persons identification through the intersection of social, biological, and technological elements.
To discuss her paper, Self-Reported Ancestry and Craniofacial SNPs, Assessing Correspondence with Implications for Forensic Case Analysis and Reporting, co-written by Drs. Michelle Hamilton and Bridget Algie Hewitt, from the Volume 4, Number 4, Special Issue, Ancestry Estimation and Its Implications for Forensic Anthropology and Beyond. Could you please briefly describe the article and give three main takeaways?
Yes. So this article looked at the linearity between assigned population and self-identification through the examination of two types of data set. So we're using in here craniometrics, which in this article, we employed 13 of them, and another data set, which is genetic data using SNPs, which are called single nucleotide polymorphism. And these are a type of genetic markers that have been identified by different studies to be significant in a certain population. We tested in this article only 20 of them. Basically, we tried to see what's the relationship between both of them and how it connects together to a larger population. I would say the three main takeaways in this sense is a lot of the discussion when we are talking about genetics and the phenotype, we tend to forget about the social part of an individual where this all goes into. So we always need to remember that there's different terms that even though they sometimes try to explain the same thing, it's totally different. And social identity is different than self-identification, which is different than biological ancestry and different than geographical affinity. And in that sense, those terms are interchangeable in the criminal justice system, and it is important to distinguish between all of them. I would say another thing is, and once you read this article, you'll see that we had different examples where an individual can have multiple identities. And when we are using the word identity, we are talking about how a person is described, but also how they describe themselves. And these identities are how you say who you are and what you are actually can coexist together and can intersect. So like, for example, let's say if someone had like parents from two different like ethnicities, then they will say, okay, like I identify with this one and this one. But then, okay, I have like, does that make me, I have like two races or like one, but also this is social. How does it implicate any biological, like in our phenotype and in our genetics? So we're trying to look at this in this article. And I would say the third one, which is one of the most important ones, is trying to understand that genotype-phenotype relationship is not straightforward and the genetic underpinning of an individual is complex and may not always correspond to their phenotype. So just putting this out there is because there has been a lot of studies that just do A plus B equals C, but it's way more different. There's like an E flying over or like a D like just around it. So just keep that in mind when you are talking about this relationship, especially that it is a new field in biological anthropology and we are seeing a lot of new studies that are discussing the genotype phenotype. So we are anthropologists, but we also need to see in the geneticist world and the biology world what all the different literature that has been going on.
That was perfect. That was amazing. Oh, wow. I can't wait to talk about the social stuff and get your point of view on all of that implication and what that could mean. And yeah, the case study in here, I think, is a really good, it exemplifies, I think, what you're, all the things you want to talk about in a really interesting way. So to keep laying the foundation, can you quickly describe your previous work on SNPs and cranial form?
Yes. So this article was actually a continuation work of a previous article that I was working on, which was my master thesis. So in that work, we tried to look at the relationship between those SNPs that we were discussing that happens from GWAS studies. And GWAS, which is called genome-wide association studies, are actually populations-based approaches that mostly geneticists do and mostly anthropological biologists do, and that look at the relationship between the phenotype and the genotype. And what they found is that within a population, there is specific genetic markers that are significant enough to be found within the whole population, that there's enough people that they have this genetic marker. So it must be doing something, but it's also related to a specific part of the face. And this is where my interest came in. So if we are having all these studies being done, and then some of these studies are being used into the forensic field, and I'll talk about this in a bit, how can we actually know if this correlation is accurate? How can we use these genetic markers in our forensic anthropology work and forensic facial reconstruction, all this information? So I tried to test whether the SNPs that were from the GWAS studies performed on the soft tissue actually correlate with the hard tissue, which is the skull. And I used the same individuals, which is in the same what they did in the GWAS studies. I didn't use different individuals. And then through like bootstrap modeling and correlation, I was able to find that, yes, we have some of those genetic markers that we can use that can have an effect on the skull and the face, but also others that did not. And some of them actually created the new relationships that were not explored in with the soft tissue studies.
So a follow-up question I would have is, what kind of data are you pulling from these? My assumption is it's frequency data of these different SNPs that you're looking at, or are you looking at, so these are based off, these are like meta studies where they, it's just compounding information, right?
Yeah. So what they do is actually they go into, like, they collect a bunch of data from a specific population. They do a 3D scan of the face of living individuals. So someone will sit down and they will look at a 3D scanner. They will scan their face, and then they will take usually a blood sample or any type of DNA, and they will do DNA sequencing. Once they do a whole genome DNA sequencing, which is sequencing all their DNA, they will find basically like the SNPs that we just talked about. And we have a lot of SNPs in our DNA. And those are basically variants that happen, that occur from bases. So we can have ATCG, which is alleles. It's called like genetic alleles, and they can be different. So most of humans have, let's say, in this specific spot, a certain allele, let's say it's an A. But for a certain population, they found that specifically in this spot, there's a C instead of an A. And it's significant enough that we can find it is in most of individuals that are associated with this population. So they see like the frequency of the minor allele, which is the SNP, and the major allele, which is what's usually present in that area. And then they compare it and they have those information. So in our study, what we took is, okay, so they found that this minor allele, which let's say we said it's a C, was found in this position for this type of population. And it was also correlated with this part of the face, whether it was like the facial breadth or facial height, like the nasal border or like aperture. And like, we are like, okay, this is how it is affecting this area. So we know that it's affecting the nose and this, like the projection of the nose or like the eyelids or the cheek. And this is our findings. So this is how the GWAS work. This is on the academic side. We also have on the commercial side. And I think it's important to highlight this because in the criminal justice system, we are recently hearing a lot that we are doing DNA profiling. What does that mean? So DNA profiling is actually used by commercial institutions. And what they did is taking some of this data that was done by an educational institution and tried to see in the all this pool of genetic information, like, okay, those are the SNPs that we are finding. And a lot of them were early on based on like skin color, eye color, hair color. So they would like early on start, okay, so this individual might have like brown hair color or like a brown eye color. And then they developed into the dimension of the face. So this person might have like this, I don't know, like wider nose breadth or like bigger nose or like this, how much the eyelids are. However, one of the issues is every time they will like do, it's all probabilities and speculations, right? There isn't like, okay, it's like 1 inch wide. There is nothing like this. So what happens is in commercial settings, they actually have a collaboration between geneticists and forensic artists that will, once they get all this information, they will send it to the forensic artist and they will recreate facial approximation from all the information that they have. And the final results that come out, whether it was about a victim or a suspect or anything, it is a reproduction from the forensic artist. If some forensic anthropologists say, well, we are not related to forensic artists, I would say I would differ in a bit, because forensic art actually started in forensic anthropology at the beginning, but then once standardization started, forensic art was dropped and made as a field by itself. But still, they have meaningful work that they do in the medical legal system.
Yeah, and these types of studies, I think, can legitimize that in the eyes of a lot of people that might think about forensic artists or what they're producing as maybe not the most trustworthy of sources. But this is the type of kind of foundational research that gives that kind of legitimacy to it. And it adds kind of a scientific rigor as well, which is always, I mean, it's always a good thing to have some level of surety in what you're saying, specifically if it's going to be about something like identification, which is difficult enough as it is, even with very well-validated methods. But I think another positive to something like this is it forces anthropologists to look at, can I discuss if, or is it possible for me from a skeleton to really get an affinity? And if there's a genetic basis, then it kind of legitimizes what we do in its entirety. And if there isn't, then that's a real problem.
Yeah, exactly. In this paper, you can see that, like, even if you do everything with, like, within the forensic report and you have all the information from the biological profile, it's still doesn't provide you the whole picture.
What were the range of correlations that you found among the SNPs and the craniometrics?
So most of the stuff that I used had some sort of correlation. So what happened is I used those SNPs. I used the craniometrics from functional groups of the face that should be correlated with the soft tissue. And then after doing that, and we did experiments correlation, and we tried to identify, because it was a huge number, I had over 80 craniometrics, over 99 landmarks. So I had to like minimize this number. So we found some correlation with, like, for example, so some of the SNPs that were related to the nasal allolynx, which is basically the opening of the nose, like the small opening of the nose. This should be correlated to something related to the nose, at least, which we found that were related to the full trim, which is kind of similar, like from like the prostion to anterior nasal spine. So we like that. But then we had like some correlation with all the shin protrusion, which this wasn't significant enough in the soft tissue. Another example is we had like another one that was also related to the same area in the soft tissue, but ended up also having some correlation with the dacryons one to the other. So basically just the width and height of the like orbits. And this was not even related to like eyes and the soft tissue. So these are some of the examples that we see this correlation happening, but we didn't even know about it in the GWAS. And researchers and like even in commercial institution thought that, oh, okay, like we can just use these data from the soft tissue from living individuals and apply it to skeletal remains, and it will be great and it will work fantastically, but it doesn't. And I think that's important to acknowledge.
Yeah, shocker. Did you look at the correlation between the principal component scores and the SNPs at all? So looking at everything as like a complex as opposed to individual craniometrics.
Yeah, we did like a principal component analysis for significant SNPs early on. I didn't do like a PCA for them. I instead did a bootstrap analysis and to see this, like what's going on, and did some hierarchical analysis for clustering to see if there's any like clusters that make sense going back to like this correlation, like what's going on. And this is where the results were occurring. And we had some similarity between the clustering, the unsupervised clustering, and between like the bootstrap analysis as well.
Interesting. So these were digitized points that you're taking these from?
Yes. So I used the Microscribe 3D digitizer. And one of the reasons I've done this because I didn't have a 3D scanner to duplicate what the GWAS studies have done. However, I wanted to have as much as like accuracy as possible and precision. So I used a digitizer and I was able to get the landmarks in space. And then we ended up actually creating our own data set of inter-landmark distances, and which is the craniometrics, because we couldn't find one that would fit with what we have. Usually the sets are from like Howells. They are usually just like marked or like what we use for the forensic bank. So it's like a set data set. But I needed some stuff that will show like this mirroring that is happening on like both sides, left and right. And this is one of the reasons that ended up me using a digitizer.
Yeah, no, I think a digitizer is great. And one of the things that I thought about when I was initially reading this was Kate Spradley had a research grant comparing morphometrics, linear measurements, and inter-landmark distances, and found that inter-landmark distances outperform all of them. And it'd be interesting, I think, from a functional standpoint, looking at all of the relationships between it, because we can only interpret this as the way we measure this is correlated and not this is correlated, right? Saying something like nasal breath increase is correlated to this is just false. We can't say that with any degree of certainty. And I don't think people should think that we can say that, but there is something that's housed within the measurement. There is something of it. And that's why we'd expect to see correlations like 0.3, 0.4, as opposed to the 0.8, 0.9 that we're more happy seeing, like if we were doing like a stature regression, you know. So we're looking at things that can capture only so much of the variability. I think that I don't know where it's going. Just that, I think the inter-landmark distances is probably the way to study it, because we can never directly say there's going to be so many interactions, like gene interactions, gene environment interactions that happen that you can't control for or plan for. And it will be unavoidable noise in the data, but that's good. You expect that because that's the reality of biology.
Exactly.
Thinking any one measurement's going to be it is not, it's not sensical, because nothing and our body works that way.
Exactly. And I think that takes us to like a really important point, which is correlation does not mean causation. And it's important to acknowledge this. And like you said, we know for a fact that genetics is not equal. Like whatever we have as in our genetics, it will not 100% translate into our phenotype. We have so many things that are happening from while we were our embryos in the uterus of our mother. We will have some sort of interactions with the environment and with other genes that can affect our development and thus our phenotype. And this is important to understand these interactions, that they exist. And these interactions can happen inside the body and outside the body. So when we are saying environment, we're not only talking about like anything that is happening with us outside of our body, like we are experiencing trauma or violence. All of these are affecting it, but also there is intrinsic factors that are affecting within the body. And it's very hard to account for, because every person has this individualistic in them. It's even though we are in what we call populations, and I do have like just seeing all this, I do have some restriction on saying like when we are talking about population, because we don't have a discrete population. So even though we assign each other into populations, we still are a combination of people, and none of us are like only connected to another by just like one thing. Yeah. So I think that's like one of the.
that's wonderful. Could you briefly describe the use of PCA and FM-MBC?
Yes. So I'll start with the PCA. So PCA is principal component analysis, which is a multivariate statistical analysis that extrapolate the variation present in a set of variables and reduce them into multidimensional representation. So what we are talking about here is multivariate analysis of a reduction method. In that sense, this analysis is actually taking the set of variables that we have, which in this case, we have the cranial metrics, which are continuous data, and we have the SNPs, which are categorical data. And we are looking at them as a unit together to see how much variation is happening within them and how they are distinct from each other in one space. We are doing this. So I've done this analysis using covariation matrix because of the type of variation that we have. And this is like one of the best one. Use covariation matrix instead of correlation. And once you apply this, you actually can see some of the variation or how is it your data is going through. So in the example that we have, the cranial metrics showed like, okay, some sort of homogeneous mixture. We have like different individuals that are dependently in space present within kind of some sort of a cluster. So we are seeing some sort of cluster happening, extending from the center of the different components that we have. And the unique thing about the PCA is it's actually very informative as first space analysis. So you want to understand what's going on there. You still didn't figure out like, how much variation do you have or how it is your data going? So PCA is a good tool to understand these. And then you can inform yourself, okay, what do I do next? So it's exploratory type of analysis. However, for the FMMBC, it's a big acronym, but it's actually a very simple analysis in a way. It's not that simple. It's called Finite Mixture Model-Based Cluster Analysis. So it's a type of unsupervised cluster analysis that use a probabilistic approach to population structure analysis. So it reveals groups within data and allow sharing among these groups without the prior input of the expected numbers of groups or the nature of interrelationship. So in that sense, you kind of are removing a predetermined bias that is input by us humans into the data. And it shows a mixture of underlying probability distribution. What that means is you are trying to let the data speak for itself. So you are seeing, okay, so this is the data that I have, how it is moving into clusters. So it's kind of putting the PCA, but into like different parts altogether combined in a way or another, and then seeing what's going on. One of the things that is interesting in this statistical analysis is this is actually adopted from genetic analysis, but by one of the senior researchers that work on this project, which is Dr. Elja Hewitt. And it was actually very informative to use this analysis on continuous data, which is the cranial metrics, to see how it corresponds. In this article, we only used 13 cranial metrics because when you are using a huge data set of 2000 and plus individuals, usually a lot of them have missing data. So when I'm trying to compare my 17 samples towards those large sample, it's harder to use all these measurements. So we try to put like to use only the ones that are available without any missing data. And we were able to understand what's going on in the sample, how the small sample fit within a larger one.
That's fantastic. And the only thing I'd point out too, a benefit of using reduced variables is that regardless of what variables you're using or what data you're using, the fewer parameters you have, the more power your model has. And that's just a reality you can't get around.
Yes, I completely agree. More data doesn't give you more information. Less is best.
Yeah, well, I think it's the question. It's how you structure your question, right? If you structured your question correctly, you should know what data you need to answer it. That's a little more difficult for like exploratory or foundational studies, right? Because you're trying to find out that information to inform future research on how is this best used, right? So let's get into the results now. Was there anything that you found that was like unexpected or surprising? And if so, why?
Yes. So there was a couple of interesting results that we found. So I would say the first thing was the results from the genetic analysis was different from the results from the cranial metrics for a couple of individuals in this data, which was very interesting for me because in a sense, what I did, we were talking about GWAS, we have been talking about GWAS, about SNPs, all this information. And we said that it was population based. However, I was like, okay, they are using a European population of people who self-identify as white which I had to use in the sample to apply to the same attributes that they are using. However, since most of the research is skewed toward white individuals, unfortunately, and we don't have enough data for others, I was trying to find other ways to explore if there is something that is going on that can tell me that, okay, it doesn't need to be population-based. So I was able to find, at that time, there was research, and now there are more research, thank God, about this. But at that time, there was research about Latin American populations, where they found also several SNPs that were of significant in relation to the face in their population. So I was like, okay, I'm going to use two of them and see what can I do in this. Like, is there any of my 17 individuals that will appear that will have the SNPs? And interestingly enough, there was two of them that had these SNPs. And this is where the question is. I went to go, like we talked about, in the PCA to see, okay, where do their craniometrics fit within? And I didn't see any like major variation that is happening, or like, oh, they are skewed enough to like, okay, this person had like way out of proportion like craniometrics. They were like within other individuals. However, I went to the PCA of the SNPs, and you can see that they are a little bit skewed from the others. And this is why, because they have to, like, they have one SNP that doesn't apply to other individuals that were supposedly within a European population. So I thought that was interesting because it just gives you another understanding of like what's going on there, how is like this complexity is happening. Even though I tested 20, not all of them were present, only 9. And this is also showing, okay, we have a large pool of them present in a very small sample, which is great, but also we have a lot of them missing. So it's not always the case that we have all of them in a European self-identified as white, in quotation. And then the last thing that I thought was interesting was when we did the unsupervised cluster analysis, we found that there is a high percentage of European affinity within all the samples. Even those two samples that we just talked about, they had like way high, like they had over 90% of affinity with European according to their craniometrics. And this just shows you how homogeneous they are with each other. And even they had higher percentage than the percentage of the whole large sample, which is of 2,259. They had like, which was like 69%. Like, this shows you how like they were all like coupled together, if that makes sense.
How they were just kind of naturally clustered. So if we're assuming a continental-based geographic ancestry, you would think that an older sample would have a higher proportion of European because it's less time-derived, right? But it seems that, yeah, they became more European somehow. How did they get more European?
I think some of the stuff that you're saying like makes sense, right? Like, we have like the sample that I'm using, it's not that like older because I didn't have anyone over like 69. So they are still kind of old, but not that old. But at the same time, I would say one of the things that you would want to think about is like, where are you pulling your sample from, like the larger population? And it should be a representation of US population. So even though it is discussing only the, in quotation again, white people who are of European affinity, they actually are providing an actual example of how like diverse the Hmong population is in the US. So even though they are of population affinity, they aren't as well. And I think I made a good job picking my sample.
My thought was that for the finite mixture, for the data set that's used to populate that, it's so many different samples and nomenclature wasn't the best, you know, or the things that we're saying are European, right? Because we're using this European, even though from that data set, there is a lot of Europeans, but there's a lot of American whites too being called European.
True.
And I think maybe it could be conflating the idea that a Europeanization is kind of the thing we see in like the white population of noses getting narrower and taller. And we're saying that's European, but in reality, Europe's way more diverse than that. Yeah, I think there's a lot of things, but to me, the most striking is that there's something that we're clearly not being able to capture with our craniometrics that is something that has a lot of valuable information, particularly in an identification effort. And I'm thinking in particular about that, what individual 15 or whatever, whatever the individual that you did like the background research on.
Yeah, the 14 and 5, yeah.
Maybe there was some sort of kind of Latinx influence as well, given these markers.
So just also another point I just realized now while talking to you is another thing is that most of the sample that we have at Texas State would be probably within the state. Like we rarely had like people that we will like fly over. And this is just by proximity, right? Like we know like geographical human behavior that will go into like a certain limit. So probably most of those individuals as well are within like some sort of proximity from each other in a way or another that can have like also an effect of why they have like higher European. Oh, yeah. So going back to like the two individuals, after I found this information, I went back to like their documentation and I found like some interesting stuff actually. So one of them did put as an additional to like how they, what is, because we have a section in the donation forms as like their race and their ethnicity. So in their ethnicity, they like say what I also have some lineage of something, and they did have a lineage with like a Native American tribe. So I'm like, okay, maybe that is, I don't know.
And it proves one of your earlier points about the complexities of human identity. How do you see people putting all this to practice?
So I think one of the important thing to look at that there is so much to learn, right? Like when we are looking at these information, we are trying to understand that, okay, genetics can help us in a lot of way. It can reveal that not everything looks as it is. There is way more complexity and complication that we should consider, but also that even though we use genetics to introduce us to that, okay, there is different, we don't need to use like strictly population-based approaches in our methods. We need to understand that there is individualistic features that can help in our field. And I think that's like one of the important things in my opinion, because forensic anthropology is based on individualism, right? Because we need to have this individualistic like trait, individualistic point that we find in the remains so we can identify them. And using methods that were population-based might skew this and not provide all the information that we need because we are limiting ourselves within and constraining ourselves within this cluster of information. And I think one of the issues that we can approach as a field is moving on, you need to question everything. Try to see that, okay, we have these new studies that are looking at like craniometrics, are looking at genetics, but we need to understand like why everything is happening. We need to understand why we are using these traits to see like we have this divide in our field currently that we have people that only want to focus on science and others, they want to incorporate social issues as well and advocacy. And there is this big divide within the two sides. And I think that's hurting the field. And instead, they should like collaborate together because we need both parts in order to reach what forensic anthropology is all about.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think we're all better together. And we're all working on a problem that has no solution. And I think that's why I like anthropology is you can only find out more, but you can never figure it out, you know, but we can get better at figuring it out if we abandon the thought that we can solve it or we have solved it and we don't need each other anymore. That's so ridiculous.
Yes, I agree. And when we are talking like, I know in this article, we touch upon like what is identity, and it is really like it's part of the characteristics of an individual, right? And it can be perceived differently. It can be defined differently, and it can create this like interactive multidimensional system. And when I was reading about it and like trying to incorporate all of it. There was one of the, from the social theory authors, used an example, and I think it's really nice one, which is seeing identities and seeing all of our identities as a cube, right? Like,
yeah, the Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, the Rubik's Cube. So we have all these small like squares that are connecting to each other to make a cube, but each one of them is different. And each one of them complement the other, because without the existence of one, the rest cannot exist to make the cube. But at the same time, they are like a collective, but also as individual. And this is just for one person. So imagine a whole population that you are assigning stuff to, and you're saying that that's it, like this is what it is, and it's not.
Yeah, that's such a great analogy. Yeah, I had underlined that in the paper, so I'm glad you brought it up.
Oh.
Yeah, I imagine seeing like that Rubik's Cube, and then it like zooms out and there's like a million Rubik's Cubes. You're like, oh yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, I took a bunch of those from like a sociology like class I took, and I was like, yes, this is so interesting. We need to learn this more in anthropology. Like, why aren't we learning all this stuff? And it's so important. So,
yeah. It's an unfortunate reality, I think, of the way that anthropology is structured in the United States, wherein I feel mostly the anthropologists that I know and went to school with would consider themselves skeletal biologists, as opposed to like physical anthropologists, because they don't want to be associated with the cultural element. And when I was younger, I felt that way too, because I was like, yay, hard science. I got a p-value, so yes. I know the world. And then you realize, once you figure out how little that actually means, you're like, wow, my certainty of my opinions went from 100% to like zero.
Yes, exactly. And this is what I was telling you, like I came from forensic science, right? So it's all about hard science. And when people like figure out like anthropology, like why did you choose that? Like where did it come from?
And you must hate yourself too.
No, I actually like it now more than DNA. So it's an improvement.
That's interesting. Well, it's good that we have people like you to bridge that gap. Because this will end up being the foundation that our field has to stand on, or it falls apart, right? If we can't find some meaningful genetic link, then all these theories we're postulating about population histories and people movement stuff off of the stuff that it supposedly has a high genetic component, and we realize it doesn't. Then what are we left with, you know? So,
yeah, I used to say I'm a biological anthropologist at the beginning, but now I just say anthropologist, because I think, and even if you use biocultural anthropology, that's another like wormhole that you go into. So I'll just say anthropologist, but you always get backfire from using like this approach, a lot of backfire, even from mostly from senior researcher. And it's harder when you are still a junior.
Oh yeah. That power dynamic is weird. I do not miss being a student, but I love learning.
Yeah. No, it's always great to keep learning. And I think that's one of the important things that we should acquire for, is like never stop learning. Whenever, like even if in 10 years or so, we're going to have new methods, we're going to have new stuff happening. So we always need to keep learning.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Do you think there are any other potential implications this research might have for the field other than what we've discussed?
I think there's more acceptance of like the incorporation of DNA with anthropological research. Like a decade ago, it was like kind of like, oh no, like DNA, we don't know anything about it, like keep it away from us kind of a thing. But now you are seeing a more kind of acceptance toward like, yes, incorporation. We have more genetic anthropologists, and especially talking about like these issues specifically, right? Like before, you would have the evolutionary anthropologists or like focusing on the phenotype, but like in primates or like in like for like locomotion or something totally different from forensic anthropology. And I think there is a shift in like understanding these information for the sake of forensic anthropology to ameliorate it. And this shift will actually help a lot in the future. So I just see this shift, and I think I'm glad students are like going through that.
Yeah, agreed. So if you could start all over, is there anything you would have done differently with this research?
I wish there was other studies that highlighted other than like the European affinity, because in that sense, I'm kind of going into the same mainstream that I'm saying not to. I wish I had like the opportunity to do that, but I didn't. And I think the other thing I would say is I would have outsourced DNA analysis.
So what you're wishing for is having had more money when you started.
Yes, I did a very cost-effective way for DNA analysis. I even like dropped the cost to like a couple of hundreds per sample, which is usually 1,000 per sample.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I died trying to do that, so...
Were you making backdoor deals with some DNA?
No. I applied a multiplex analysis approach, and I did a lot of different available techniques that didn't need kit, so that like drive the cost really low. And I also ended up, I had like in the lab that I was working at, we had the data, like we had all this, like the library preparation kits and all this stuff. A lot of other researchers were already like struggling with like retaining like what is the right concentration, all this stuff. So I think what helped was like having this information to like recreate my own library. And I was lucky to like have like a good result from like only my second run in sequencing, because this is really rarely happen usually. So that saved me a lot of money as well.
Wow. That's wild. That's incredible. It's like a DIY.
Yes.
That is admirable. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, so yeah, if anybody's looking to cut costs, I guess that's the way to do it.
Yes. Yes.
All right. So what's next for this type of research?
So I think more data, like way more data of individuals. We have this unique position now that we have collections that hold both skeletal elements and blood cards, which we can extract DNA from, which is way more cost effective and like accessible than like getting DNA from bones and extracting them. So we have this opportunity. We have more samples, hopefully not that representative sample, but we still have a sample. So I think the next step is to actually try to have this analysis on a larger sample, because 17 is not that informative, right? Like we need more data to have more insights into what's going on, getting this and analyzing more SNPs. Like I said, like just in a couple of years, we had like more than double the SNPs that are available for us to look at. And there's always going to be GWAS studies because they are a different field. They are doing their own thing and we can always find information about them. So I would say just like, since we know now that they cannot use it directly and there's to the skeleton at least, we need to do that work and try to work through these technicalities to see like what we can use and what we can't.
Thank you so much to Amar for such an insightful chat, and thank you for listening. Our next episode will be with several authors from the article, Terminology Used to Describe Human Variation in Forensic Anthropology, also from Special Issue, Volume 4, Number 4. Until then, be good.